broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by ProLiance Energy. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.
Welcome to the Indiana Public Broadcasting series of speakers from the Economic Club of Indiana in downtown Indianapolis. Indianapolis Public School Superintendent Eugene White talked to the club on Tuesday, January 22nd. He told members Indiana schools are doing well, but they could do better, especially when it comes to providing a solid education to all students. White says it's time to rethink what it means to provide a high-quality education for children in urban areas. Economic Club President James Mosley introduces Eugene White.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're not going to ring a bell like a classroom today, but I would like to call you to attention. Sometimes a change will do some good. That's what Indianapolis Public School Superintendent Eugene White believes. Following his remarks today, we will have a brief question and answer session. If you have a question in your mind as you are listening to him, please jot it down on the white card provided on your table, and when he's finished, bring it to the stage and we'll ask the questions. When Dr. White came to IPS 3 years ago, he was prepared to combat declining enrollments, low test scores, and plummeting graduation rates. Now Dr. White is rolling out major initiatives to improve student chances for success. Topping the list, uniform-style dress code, redistricting that will close 8 schools, a stricter discipline process, more magnet schools, and smaller high schools. Today there are significant signs of progress beginning for 37,000 students in IPS. Elementary and middle schools reported significant improvements in their ISTEP scores this school year. Progress that many credit to Dr. White's change in the culture in the district. Often described as a visionary, Dr. White believes there's nothing better than education to lift someone out of poverty, something he knows from personal experience. Growing up in segregated Alabama during the Jim Crow period, he became the first person in his family to graduate from high school. He earned degrees from Alabama A&M University, University of Tennessee, and Ball State University. He spent his career in public positions as a teacher, coach, and school administrator. Dr. White's passion for education is something that he's shared with his family. Both of his children are now teachers and coaches in Marion County. Dr. White spent 11 years as superintendent of the Metropolitan School District of Washington Township before coming to the Indianapolis Public Schools in 2005. His decision to switch districts was influenced by his mission to start a revolution in the urban schools. He was named the 2002 Indiana Superintendent of the Year and the 2007 National Association of Black School Educators Superintendent of the Year. Please join me in welcoming IPS Superintendent Dr. Eugene White.
Thanks, Jay, for that nice introduction. It's wonderful to be here this afternoon. I want to personally thank Wayne Smith and for gathering up people, and I think you encouraged more people to be here than I could count. So that's an outstanding effort on your part, Wayne. I have a lot of thoughts to share with you today, but because I know that I wouldn't have enough time really to win you over to my views, I'm going to try to follow the 3 rules of public speaking. Stand up to be seen, speak up to be heard, and shut up to be appreciated. But I'm not going to allow you to appreciate me too much, so I have several things I have to share with you. Hopefully, in the course of my comments, I can generate a thought, maybe an agitation, a question, and maybe a little hope among us. In case someone should ask you when you return to your office, wherever, what I talked about today, my topic is the blueberries, the hope, and you. The blueberries, the hope, and you. I was torn in terms of what kind of speech to give you, because I could spend many hours talking about what we're doing in IPS, but I decided that I wanted to give you a general overview of my thoughts in public education right now. In talking to a group of business executives about public education, I'm reminded of Jamie Robert Vollmer, a former business executive and attorney. And as a businessman, he thought he knew all the answers for the public schools. He was conducting an in-service program for a school district one day, and this is his story. It's really called the Blueberry Story, or the teacher gives the businessman a lesson. He said, if I ran my business the way you people operate your schools, I wouldn't be in business very long. Mr. Vollmer said as he stood before an auditorium filled with outraged teachers who were becoming angrier by the minute, my speech had entirely consumed their precious 9 minutes of in-service. Their initial icy glares had turned to restless agitation. You could cut the hostility with a knife. Mr. Vollmer said he represented a group of business people dedicated to improving public schools. I was an executive, he said, with an ice cream company that became famous in the mid-1980s when People magazine chose their blueberry as the best ice cream in America. He said he was convinced of two things. First, public schools needed to change. They were archaic, selecting and sorting mechanisms designed for the industrial age and out of step with the needs of our emerging knowledge society. Second, educators were a major part of the problem. They resisted change, hunkered down in their feathered nests, protected by tenure and shielded by a bureaucratic monopoly. They needed to look to business. We knew how to get things done. We knew how to produce quality with zero defects, total quality management, continuous improvement. In retrospect, he said, my speech was perfectly balanced, equal parts ignorance and arrogance. Mr. Vollmer said, as soon as he finished his speech, he said a woman's hand shot up. She appeared polite, pleasant. She was, in fact, a razor-edge veteran high school English teacher who had been waiting to unload. She began quietly. We are told, sir, that you managed a company that makes good ice cream. I smugly replied, best ice cream in America, madam. How nice, she said. Is it rich and smooth? Oh, 16% butterfat. I crowed. Premium ingredients? She inquired. Super premium. Nothing but AAA. I was on a roll. I never saw the next line coming. Mr. Vollmer, she said, leaning forward with a wicked eyebrow raised to the sky, when you are standing on your receiving dock and you see an inferior shipment of blueberries arrive, what do? He said, in the silence of that room, I could hear the trap snap. He said, I was dead meat, but I wasn't going to lie. He said, I send them back. She says, that's right. And we can never send back our blueberries. We take them big, small, rich, poor, gifted, exceptional, abused, frightened, confident, homeless, rude, and brilliant. We take them with ADHD, junior rheumatoid arthritis, and English as a second language. We take them all, everyone. And that, Mr. Vollmer, is why it's not a business, it's a public school. In an explosion, All 290 teachers, principals, bus drivers, aides, custodians, and secretaries jump to their feet and yell, "Yeah, blueberries, blueberries, blueberries." And so began the long transformation of Jamie Robert Vollmer. He now works as a motivational speaker and consultant to increase support for public schools in this country. Since then, he has visited hundreds of schools, and he has learned that a school is not a business. Schools are unable to control the quality of their raw materials. They are dependent upon the vagaries of politics for a reliable revenue stream, and they are constantly mauled by howling hordes of desperate competing consumer groups, or customer groups. Now, let me be very clear. This blueberry story is true. It really happened. Our work does provide variables different from most of your businesses. However, education is a business. It is the business of preparation. It is the business of opportunity. It is the business of hope. And it also is the business of freedom. Public education is the bedrock of our democratic way of life. We are a great country because we were the first country that dared to educate all of its children. A democratic republic depends upon an educated and informed populace. We must never forget that freedom isn't free. The price, and there is a price to pay for freedom. Many think of this price as the one our soldiers pay with their lives on the field of battle and wars and conflicts, and that is true. However, there is another price. The first price is the one paid in educating our children to value and protect our way of life. Education for freedom depends on all citizens meeting the duties and responsibilities of supporting the preparation of our children, which is our future. Public education changes lives. As I stand before you today, I am living proof that public education works. I am valid evidence that education is the key that opens the doors to vocational and economic opportunities for those at the bottom of society. I'm truly proud to say that despite the segregation, the racism, and the poverty in 1940s, 50s, and 60s in Southeast Alabama, despite not having school books, despite not having a public library, nor appropriate school facilities, despite growing up in a single-parent home in a prejudiced society, despite these things and many more, education provided a way out for me. Public education provided hope and freedom, and it could only happen in a country that dares to educate all its children. My story is not unique. It is repeated by thousands and millions of people in this country. It occurred not only in Jim Crow, de facto segregated Alabama, but in Indiana and many other states in this union. Public education was and continues to be the key to liberation, to economics, to social and political progress. Public education has made this country a special place to live, and it has made us the greatest nation in the world. John F. Kennedy once said, "Our progress as a nation can be no swifter than our progress in education. The human mind is our fundamental resource." Some among you may say, that was yesterday. That was in our century, the American century. Now we are in the world of information technology, a service society. We're in a world that depends less on raw materials and industrial might and more on information and brain power. We are now competing against astounding numbers. We now compete with China, a country with numbers so large that the top 25% of their students in China with the highest IQ in that country, that number is greater than the total population of North America. In India, it's the top 28% of students with the highest IQ, that population is larger than the population of North America. In other words, they have more honor students than we have people in North America. China will soon become the top English-speaking country in the world. There are no signs of this changing because China and India are exploding with new birth. There are 8 babies born in the United States every minute. There are 31 babies born every minute in China and 44 babies born every minute in India. We are competing against massive numbers of students smarter, working harder to lead the world. We average 180 days in school per year, and they average more than 200-plus days in school per year, plus weekend tutoring classes and mentoring. All of this information is true. The nations of the world beyond China and India are rising on the strength of educating their people to live and prosper in the 21st century. Dublin, Ireland is a great example of this educational explosion. Well, what about us? What about the United States of America? I'm truly proud to share with you today that the answer for us is not a new answer. The answer is still public education. Because Thomas Jefferson was correct when he said, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, they expect what never was and never will be. So the answer is very, very clear to us. The question, however, is different now. The question is not how are we going to compete against China, India, and those other countries. That's not the question. The question is, are we truly ready to do it right this time and provide the highest quality of education for all of our children? The highest quality of education for all of our children. This is different from my day or your day, because in my day, even the public education for white children in Southeast Alabama was of low quality. In those days, we expected to lose at least half of the children before they graduated from high school. As a matter of fact, the graduation rate of students in Indiana was less than 50% in 1950. And we are not counting the ones who never came to school after kindergarten, or the special education students who were separated or denied the opportunity for education. So our day wasn't really as great as we look back and think it was. Until 30 years ago, unprepared or underprepared students could leave school and work in agriculture or industrial economies with low education and still meet all of the adult tasks and responsibilities. They could marry, have children, and send their children to college. Today, that underprepared child must remain in school and attempt to acquire a college education or its equivalent. Are we ready to provide a quality education for all the children this time? If we are going to compete against China, India, and the other nations, we must change our attitude and approach about public education. Remember, we lost the war in Vietnam. We lost the war on poverty because we have more poverty today than ever before. We lost the war on drugs because we pick up the paper every day and see these people blowing away each other over drugs. They're even killing babies now. But we cannot afford to lose the war on ignorance. However, it's not easy to truly educate all the children effectively because many of them are impacted so severely by poverty, health care needs, lack of preschool preparation, child care problems, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We can pass the No Child Left Behind law to educate them, but laws without funding are empty mandates, political in nature, and humanly dishonest. I repeat, laws without funding those laws are empty mandates, political in nature, and humanely dishonest. We can't allow one snapshot assessment of our children to determine the success of preparation of our children. The I-STEP Plus test is important, but it is not more important than the citizenship test. Our students must be able to read, write, compute, think, and learn. However, we face a silent epidemic in this country. More than 1 million high school students drop out of school every year. That is one student every 29 seconds. It is projected that this problem will be worse by 2020 without significant change. I'm sad to say our expectations for our children haven't been high enough to truly provide the kind of pre-kindergarten to undergraduate education needed to allow us to stay a great nation. In Indiana, we don't legally have to start school before age 7. That's kind of late in this day and time. Our number of poor children in this state are growing, and the number of students who speak English as second language is exploding. In IPS, 14% of our students are Hispanic Latino, and most of them speak English as a second language. Waiting to educate them at kindergarten is too late. They need preschool education or early childhood education by the age of 3 to 5. 20% of the nation's 4-year-olds receive pre-K education, and only about 3% of the 3-year-olds receive pre-K education. These are the kind of education programs they provide in states like Iowa and Illinois. There are 36 states funding pre-K education, but Indiana is not one of them. We can't even fund for the kindergarten in the state. It is unrealistic to provide less than the rest and expect the results to be as high as the rest. It might be politically correct, but it is humanely dishonest and short-sighted to do our children this way. No, we can't send back our blueberries, ladies and gentlemen. We must take all the blueberries because we are public schools. But we can change the soil and growth conditions that spawn our blueberries. We can better prepare them for the journey. We can get them ready for school. We can get schools ready to educate them. We must raise our standards and expectations for all of our children. There is a new documentary, and maybe some of you have seen, called 2 Million Minutes, A Global Examination. It asserts that the U.S. students typically devote 4 less time to their studies, both in and out of high school, than their 4-year high school counterparts in China and India. Ironically, in the 1950s, they did the same kind of comparison with U.S. students and Soviet students. They found that the Soviet students were more on task and focused than the U.S. students. So that part of it hasn't changed, but it's a totally different time. Speaking of time, time spent in high school in China amounts to 583,000 minutes. Time spent in high schools in India amounts to 422,400 minutes. Time spent in high schools in this country, 302,400 minutes. Again, we're doing less and expecting to get more in return. Is that realistic for our children? Is that fair for our children? Americans must raise our expectations for our adults and children. We're working to improve the quality of teaching, and we need more time on task because we found out that time is indeed the missing ingredient, not only in the families and the communities, but in school, time is missing. However, for us, time is money, and currently money doesn't allow 500,000 minutes or 400,000 minutes in high school for our children. The India's and China schools are not perfect, don't get me wrong, because quite frankly, in China and India, they don't even attempt to educate all their children, and you can't find a special needs child in these particular schools. But those students who are in the schools in China and India have a greater focus on the value of hard work and the value of a solid education. Now, we must do more to focus our parents and students on the value of education. To paraphrase that old Ford Motor Commercial Company commercial, education should be job one. It's been a long time since we got serious enough to say education is job one. Matter of fact, now we allow our students to take it or leave it. Kids come home from school and say, I'm going to quit. The parent says, why? They say, because no one out there likes me, and it's okay. In my day, I would have been dead because my mother would have killed me. In IPS, our students score on the state ISTEP Plus exams. Our scores are rising in grades 3 through 7. Quite frankly, we're very pleased with what we're doing in grades 3 through 7. However, our high school scores are still abysmal, and we have to do something about that. And you will see that we have all kind of options and initiatives in place to get that done. 70% of our 6th and 7th grade students scored 70% of them passed the ISTEP Plus mathematics exam. And through programs like RITA, supported by the United Way of Central Indiana and the Corporate Volunteer Council, we were raised in language arts scores also of our students. And I need to pause here to say a big thank you to United Way of Central Indiana and for the Corporate Volunteer Council. I was told today that we have more than 526 volunteers working in our RITA program. Ellen Allen from United Way always keeps me updated on the RITA program. We believe that it's going to take efforts like that. Earlier in Wayne Township, Dr. Terry Thompson has a comprehensive volunteer program similar of getting people from their jobs to come and read and work with students in school. You see, he understands and we understand we can't do this alone in the schools. Our teachers are teaching the state standards, and we're starting to make the needed progress to be the best urban school district in this country. That's our goal. We have more educational choices and options for our parents in IPS than any school district in the state of Indiana. We are reintroducing hope to our community, hope in how we work with children and the parents, and hope in future possibility for our children. Someone asked me, in your 2 years of superintendent, Dr. White, what's the number one thing that you have achieved? Even though we have many initiatives, we're starting to see scores get better. I think the number one thing we have achieved is we have reinstituted a sense of hope in our schools and in our community. And you can't take hope for granted. Hope is a very powerful factor. We can never underestimate the power of hope. As a matter of fact, after the Oklahoma City bombing, they used dogs to comb through the wreckage and destruction looking for bodies. After a few days, the dogs stopped eating, and they demonstrated signs of severe depression. You see, they only were finding dead people, and they lost hope. The experts decided to hire some living people in the rubble for the dogs to find. After a few days of finding some living people, the dogs started to eat again and to wag their tails again. Even in the lower order of the animal kingdoms, animals know the need for hope. Instilling and rejuvenating hope is our mission in IPS. It is the mission of public education in this country. A man who helped bring hope to our children died recently. His name was Dr. Laura Rose. Dr. Rose worked all of his adult life to educate, administer, supervise, and guide children, educators, people of Indiana and the nation. He believed that the children of Indiana could and would be successful if they were given the resources and opportunities to do so. Dr. Rose once said, I am often asked, how good are the Indiana schools? My answer, they are far better than they are given credit for being, but not as good as they need to be. Dr. Rose demonstrated the power of hope in public education because he was a product of public education. Now, many of you are products and beneficiaries of public education. What was true in your day is still true, but too many have forgotten those days and have lost hope in the power of public education. Our two major educational challenges in Indiana today are making sure that each child achieves proficiency in language arts, mathematics, science, social studies, but it's just as important to make sure that they have training in citizenship, in education, in the arts, and in the technical areas. Our children need a well-rounded, comprehensive education, but excessive tests are forcing us to restrict the curriculum and to flatten out their school experiences. We need to close the achievement gap that exists between Black and Hispanic students and their white counterparts, because in many situations, Black and Hispanic students are trailing white students by 20-plus points in language arts scores and 17-plus points in math scores, and we have to do something about that, and we can do it. I want to close today with two observations about people in public education. One, we have become soft in our effort to ensure future success for our children. This consists of two basic kinds of softness. One, Our will is too weak. We accept excuses and expect too little from our adults and our children. Smart is not something you just are. Smart is something you can become. Too many of us think that academic success is the result of native intelligence. Many Asians and Eastern thinkers are more likely to think that success is the result of hard work. The difference in these two positions is very important. If success is the result of intelligence, and intelligence is something that's given by birth or heredity, then you either have it or you don't. However, if success is the result of hard work, it's an open market of opportunity for all children. Too many people allow people to just get by because they don't have the will to hold them accountable. Too many of us believe that only a small percentage of children are really bright enough to become truly educated. It's not true. All children can be truly educated. Attitude is just as important as aptitude. We must have the will to insist that all children are educated. We can do it because in the early 1960s, when I was a young man, President John F. Kennedy said, "We are going to the moon." And we walked on the moon's surface by the late 1970s. We must exert greater will, kind of like the will we exerted at the national level to go in space, if we are to educate all our children. I believe it's easier than going to the moon. That will requires more attention, more resources, and more accountability. We must elevate our will and force a new attitude of achievement in our schools, but not just in our schools, in our homes, in our jobs, in our lives. Schools are just a reflection of the society in which they exist. The will to win, the will to be the best, is very, very important to us. In his book, Good to Great, Jim Collins said that good is the enemy of great. America's ability to be great is definitely compromised by our will to just be good enough. Secondly, we as a people are compromised because of our selfishness and greed. We are losing the lessons of our legacy. We have forgotten the things our forefathers did to make this a great nation. We have forgotten that we are where we are today because we are standing on the gifts and the greatness of other people. We owe it to the next generation to prepare them for a success that is equal to or greater than our achievements. We must pay the investment required to ensure our children's liberties. We must value the thought of Henry Ward Beecher, who said, "We should so live and labor in our time that which came to us as seed may go to the next generation as blossom, and that which came to us as blossom may go to them as fruit." This is what we mean by progress. We are running away, living behind walls, and attempting to isolate ourselves from the negatives and circumstances in today's society. Many people believe that they are not getting their money's worth out of public education, so why throw good money after bad? We don't see any fundamental changes taking place in public education. I say to those people this afternoon, you need to look closer. We are educating more students successfully today than ever before in the history of this country. But the rules of the game have changed. We are now expected to educate every child, and we need your support. Our children are coming to us poorer than ever before, more diverse than ever before, shackled with more psychological and social baggage than ever before. They have an information overload with little or no understanding. They are compromised by the media like no other generation in history. They are misunderstood, some are feared, but they, you should know, are the brightest children in the history of this country. They are the millennial generation. They are the hope for this country, and they need adults willing to stop running, stop hiding, stop underappreciating and fearing them. They need us to expect more from them and to do more for them from birth to adulthood. They need our hope to create greater hope for themselves. If you are a product of a public school, you were one of those blueberries I talked about today. You were not perfect, but we took you anyway. You were not always correct, but we kept you anyway. You didn't always act like a perfect little blueberry, but we loved and supported you anyway. Aren't you glad we accepted all of the blueberries? With your support, the blueberries of today will grow and progress in our public schools. With your hope, the blueberries will create a bright tomorrow. Thank God for the blueberries. Thank God for the hope. Thank God for you, and thank God for our great country. Thank you very much.
We have time for a brief question and answer session. If you have a question to ask, please write it on one of the white cards and send it up forward, please. A few of you gave me questions before hearing Dr. White, which seemed to be relevant to his remarks. Your fast action changing several principals impressed me. What are your plans for attacking other school problems, such as large class size?
Large class size is really predicated on our financial situation. Ideally, we would like to have class sizes of 1 to 22. Realistically, that's not going to happen because our budget and revenue sources says that we have to be realistic when we set up these class sizes. Unfortunately, I think we bought class size to class size idea hook, line, and sinker. When you look at research on class size, there's no doubt class size is important. Matter of fact, the ideal class size is 1-to-1. That's a Socratic class size. But we're not going to get there. We're in a situation now that we're going to try to do the very best with what we have, realizing that these classes in China and India have 40 and 45 kids in one class. Class size is very important, but we believe that setting a climate for instruction, setting a climate for learning, making sure that we have resources and the support necessary to ensure success of those students would get it done overall. A 1 to 28 class size is not a bad class size. For some people, they think that's a bad class size. If you go to Park Tudor and you have a 1 to 13 class size or 1 to 15 class size, then you're blessed, you have money, good luck to you. If you go to a public school, you're not going to get those kind of numbers. So I don't think our class size numbers are really that high when you compare nationally and you look at class sizes. So that's not our biggest problem.
We have a number of questions that refer to what's going on elsewhere in town. Other than additional funding, for example, what can state government leaders do to help schools improve public education? And a lot of these questions focus on how would the governor's proposal on taxes and referenda impact IPS's future?
How much time we have? This is something you need to know. First of all, I don't think we appreciate what we've done in Indiana enough. We've done more with less in this state. When I talk about our in Illinois and what they do with funding pre-K education, four-day kindergarten, that's been happening for years. When you look at what we've done in the Dr. Reed, to get this state at a level of achievement that's equal to some of those states, we have to be very, very proud of that. I think the legislature is up against a rock and a hard place. They say I have the toughest job in this city. But during this term, my job is not tougher than our legislators. Some of them are looking at survival. Matter of fact, they have people threatening them, beating on tables, saying they're going to be roadkill. Well, I think people threaten me, too, but they don't do it in my face. But my point with the legislature, we are aware, one, the tax situation in Marion County something has to happen across the state. But Marion County, where we live, it is an imperative that something has to happen. We realize that. realize that residential property taxes have to be addressed. At the same time, what they need to understand is school districts have certain needs, and you can't say we can throw all your money in one pot and then losing $5 million or $20 million won't make a big difference, because it doesn't work that way. All of our monies are somewhat dedicated or restricted to some particular project. Our only point was, we've been talking about the circuit breaker caps on taxes. Our biggest point is, unlike some of the other local governments, we have no means to generate a new revenue source to offset the loss that we have. We have these circuit breakers. So they say, okay, IPS, you're going to lose $20 million, and it's going to come out of your capital project fund and school bus replacement fund. That seems simple to do, but it's very difficult, because we know that we have funds already stressed to the limit in those two areas. And it means that we're going to have to do less for our children. We're going to have to do less for a group of students that already have less. They're more deprived. They're more needy. And we're saying that because we have a high-tax, low-assessed district, you're going to pay double. We have to get legislators to understand that something has to happen to give school district relief from the offset of these circuit breakers and these caps. That may be to exempt us from it or to give us a new revenue stream to offset those losses, but something has to happen in that particular way. Meanwhile, God bless the Pope and God bless our legislators.
Three people picked up on the blueberry metaphor to ask what to do about the blueberries that don't come bruised. Are well-prepared children being challenged, getting an excellent education, or are we paying too much attention or all of the energy given to those that are bruised?
They're all blueberries. Some of them just are a little brighter in texture. Those bright blueberries we have, one of our initiatives is next year we're starting our version of the Sycamore School, which is a gifted and talented school. For next year we'll have grades 2, 3, 4, 5. We don't think we have as many gifted students as their parents seem to think. We really believe that we have programs based on the feedback we received that's serving students very well. But we do understand that we have to do more in all of our schools to challenge and inspire those students who are very able. Because when you break down our performance, one of the lowest achieving groups we have is our most able students. So we're not challenging them like we should, and we have some work to do in that area. We're starting not only with this Seitner Academy, it's going to be a gifted and talented academy, but we're also working with our principals and our different divisions to improve programs in the schools for those kids who are able to go further. In our high schools we're developing, we'll have three types of high schools coming up. We'll have community high schools. We have four of those. We have what we call magnet high schools, and we have traditional high schools. We will allow, in our community high schools, they start at grade 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. In our magnet high schools, they will start at grade 6. Students at grade 6 and 7 who can take high school courses for credit, everyone that will be able to do that. So we intend to get those students accelerated if they have the ability to do so. We also want to be realistic, and that is, just because you have the aptitude does not mean you have the discipline to be in those type of situations. Might not mean you have the attitude for what the social impact of that will be, but we will work with parents and students. And we think over the next 3 years, we probably will present more options to accelerate more students, especially after grade 6, than any other district in the state. That's what we're working to do.
Early in your tenure with IPS, you stated that you would welcome competition created by charter schools. Is that still your position?
Well, it has to be my position, because it's a reality, and they seem to be adding every year. We believe that the only way for us to survive is to be able to compete. And one of my particular feelings is, if a group of people can organize a school that can educate students better than we can with our masters and doctors and specialist degrees, they deserve to have the children, because the bottom line is the children need an education. And if they can educate them better than we can, then they should have them. But be fair, because when you look at the charter schools and public schools, you need to be fair and see that we're not being outperformed by charter schools. And when you're fair to that, if all you want is an option and a choice, then that's good. But we want to make sure that we're going to be competing not only against charter schools, we want to compete against my colleagues in the other 10 school districts in Marion County and also the parochial and private schools. So we're coming at all of them. And the only way you can do that is with quality programs. And that's why we have to have the revenue to ensure that we have professional development and we employ people who can truly educate our students.
The bell is about to ring. On behalf of all the blueberries in the room, thank you for your leadership of IPS. This concludes today's luncheon. Our next luncheon is on February 21st with guest speaker Brian Gallagher, President and CEO of United Way of America. Please join me in expressing your appreciation to Dr. White, and we hope to see you next month.
Indianapolis Public School Superintendent Eugene White spoke to the Economic Club of Indiana on January 22nd. Dan Clark is a program director and spokesman for the Indiana State Teachers Association. Clark agrees with Eugene White that a highly skilled workforce is vital to creating a strong economy now and in the future, and education is key to making that happen. Dan Clark is with the Indiana State Teachers Association.
My name is Dan Clark. I work for the Indiana State Teachers Association, spend most of my time lobbying the General Assembly. Yeah, as the Indiana State Teachers Association, we represent about 45,000 teachers in most of the school corporations in the state, represent their interests in the General Assembly and before the school boards throughout the state. This year, the biggest challenge education faces is to not go backwards, but instead to find ways to move forward in the context of the challenges the state is facing. And those challenges are twofold, the property tax crisis and the emerging budget situation if the economy slows down. One of the clearest challenge the state faces in order to have a more secure economic future is to develop a workforce that is highly skilled. Given our demographics, that workforce cannot emerge if we allow achievement gaps to continue, both at the K-12 level and at the post-secondary level. We simply do not have enough children to allow 30% of them to not graduate from high school and to allow 60% of them to not graduate from college. In order to resolve these achievement gaps, it's important to understand where they come from and what can be done about it. They come from what happens to children early in life. We clearly understand that many children start school a year or two more behind the national norm, and helping those children catch up is very difficult and very costly. So we clearly have to find a way to make certain they do not start school behind. But after that, we have to find a way to make certain that they stay on track, that they graduate from high school, and are able, ready, and willing to move on to post-secondary education, either in a workforce training program or at the community college or at one of the baccalaureate institutions. The clearest thing that needs to happen between the high schools and the colleges is a much better alignment, probably beginning in late middle school, so that students understand the courses they need to complete to be ready for college, but at the same time have the opportunity on a much, much more equitable basis to actually enroll and finish college. Single biggest strategy to do that is to connect high school and college through dual credit courses so that every student who is on track to graduate, on track to complete the Core 40 curriculum, can in fact begin to take college courses in high school and finish a set of those courses, 3 to 5 courses, before they leave high school so that they are already on their way to a college degree. Indiana, in fact, has one of the least effective dual credit systems in the nation. And there will be legislation considered by the House Education Committee to better integrate the dual credit system for students so that they can begin college already with a head start and have a much better chance to complete a degree. If we had a better service system for preschool children so they didn't start school behind, then students could achieve the rigorous standards and stay on track through middle school. We could better connect them to post-secondary education as they leave high school and have a much, much better chance of them actually completing post-secondary education. The danger we face is that we fix the wrong problem. We fix the high school graduation rate at a time when most people will need post-secondary education, and we haven't done enough to fix the problems there. Indiana, for a number of years, the past half decade, has had rigorous academic standards as recognized by all of the major research organizations that look at academic standards. When you look at performance on those standards, more than 80% of the students who are not in special education and who are not eligible for the free and reduced lunch program achieve those standards. So in fact, it's kind of an unrecognized fact, but the fact of the matter is three-fourths of the students, more than three-fourths of the students who start school ready to learn, who are able to learn, can read well, are achieving high standards. It is the other students whom we cannot afford to ignore that we have to find ways to help succeed. Clearly, each classroom, each school has children with ranges of abilities. And we have to have strategies to address both ranges. We probably haven't done enough to address the aptitudes and the abilities of the high-performing students. However, we have begun to put in place systems to encourage more AP courses, more rigorous academic honors diploma courses, to encourage those students and to support their achieving at higher levels. Having said that, the success rates of those programs is uneven. And in our less affluent urban and rural school corporations, even high-achieving students don't have the opportunities that they would have elsewhere in terms of advanced science courses, advanced math courses, advanced language courses. And we have to find a way to deliver a more higher-skilled academic curriculum in places that where it's hard to deliver. There will also be legislation this year to create a virtual learning cooperative so that we can find a way, perhaps through distance learning technologies, to begin to deliver higher skills curriculum in places where they can't access it right now. And I think the thing that impresses me each day is that now is the time when people need to work together the most. Higher ed and K-12 education should be working more closely together. So should education and the business community. Failing to do that in the face of the property tax problems and the potential budget problems with the economic slowdown will clearly impede our progress, and we simply don't have time to stop.
Dan Clark is with the Indiana State Teachers Association. You've been listening to another in a series of luncheon speakers to the Economic Club of Indiana. The next speaker is Brian Gallagher. Gallagher is the president for United Way. He'll address the club February 21st. Thanks for joining us for this Indiana Public Broadcasting presentation of the Economic Club of Indiana. I'm Mary Hartnett. See you next time.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.